Hello, everybody. Good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. Glad you could be here. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on how an ATDS is defined across the country. This is one of the more confusing components to operating a company in the credit collection industry today, is knowing whether or not your firm is using an automated telephone dialing system. The reason it is confusing is because the definition is different depending on where in the country you happen to be standing at any given point in time. We're fortunate to have a panel of leading experts with us to walk through how the definition of an ATDS differs across the country. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it's got to offer. Now let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Scott Goldsmith is a litigation partner and co-chair of Dorsey's TCPA practice. He routinely defends clients in nationwide class and individual plaintiff litigation with particular emphasis on alleged violations of the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. Scott has defended more than 30 putative class actions and countless individual plaintiff claims involving the TCPA and other state and federal consumer protection statutes. He works with clients of all sizes and industries to comply with the myriad of laws regulating communication for debt collection or marketing purposes. Nicole Strickler focuses her practice in the defense of consumer litigation, including the FDCPA, Fair Credit Reporting Act, TCPA, and the Illinois Collection Agency Act. Her clients include corporations, lending institutions, collection agencies, asset purchasers, lawyers, and individuals. She's an active member of ACA International, the Consumer Financial Division of the American Bar Association, and holds a position on the board of directors for NARCA, the National Creditors Bar Association. Dara Tarkowski is a renowned legal expert shaping the future of law, technology, and highly regulated industry. As a published author, keynote speaker, and the co-founder of the legal tech startup, she's an outspoken voice on how technology is impacting the future of delivering legal and compliance advice to financial services companies. She's the managing partner of Actuate Law, a boutique law firm based in Chicago. Her legal practice centers around regulatory advocacy, compliance, and litigation for the financial services industry. She acts as outside general counsel for a national debt buyer and collection agency and works with clients across the ARM industry defending lawsuits and establishing compliance management systems and best practices. She also counsels clients on data privacy, cybersecurity, information governance, and data breach response. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing. To submit a question, please either enter it into the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel or send it all through the chat. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. Finally, to make sure nobody gets in any trouble, let me read the following disclaimer. This presentation is not intended to be legal advice and it may not be used as legal advice. Legal advice must be tailored to the specific circumstances of each case. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area. It should never be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. With that, let's launch into our discussion today. First, let's start with the basics. And Nicole, maybe you can walk us through actually how the TCPA defines an automated telephone dialing system.
Oh gosh, Mike, you start me off with the tough one, right? Well, so the TCPA itself actually does define what an ATDS is. And funny enough, when thinking about it, you have to really think about it in context of when it first came into fruition, which was in the 90s. And in the 90s, cell phones were, you know, barely making a break, so to speak, into normal society. If you had a cell phone, it was probably the size of a Zach Morris cell phone, which you had to hold with two hands, and they were very expensive. So the concern here was really with, the main concern, a privacy concern, came about kind of for two reasons, which was one, invading people's privacy at home, but more importantly, the cost associated with calling cell phones. Now, back then, the type of technology that was in play was not as sophisticated as it is now. So the way that the statute enumerated the definition of the ATDS was in reference to an automated, random and sequential number generators. So there's kind of the way that it's actually written is equipment that has the capacity to store or produce telephone numbers to be called using random or sequential number generator to dial such numbers. So, you know, it would seem, and at least probably it did seem back in the 90s when, you know, Congress enacted this act that, you know, that really only hit that a small subset of technology that really was those old, I don't want to call it rotary dialers, but those old systems that were really just generating random numbers in attempts to reach people. You know, it wasn't a scenario really where people had lists and, you know, software would dial in and call from those lists. So the actual statutory text was very geared towards, you know, the type of technology that was in play when, you know, the TCPA was created. And, you know, as we've seen, as time has gone on and on, you know, the technology has continued to advance further, to get more sophisticated, as has, you know, marketing efforts. Now, at the same time, you know, obviously cell phones have become, you know, way more utilized than they were in the 90s. And so, you know, there's a lot of arguments that have been made that essentially, you know, the old definition relative to these type of dialers should not be in play relative to today's technology. So that's kind of where we stand. And so, you know, what has occurred, I would say, in the last 10 years or so is a lot of people fighting over, you know, what is an ATDS, right? Like, what is actually the type of system that could actually be defined as an ATDS, and how do we really figure that out? Now there was, you know, quite a bit of challenges made to that statutory definition and the rules that were implemented by the FCC. So, you know, there was a large seminal case in 2015, ACA International, that came down and had a big effect on the way that, that, you know, the courts were viewing the TCPA definition. Does anyone else want to discuss ACA International with me? What do we think about it? I mean, it happened. Scott, ACA International,
yeah.
Quick.
Yeah, I'll run with ACA International.
And all right.
I think it's so appropriate to, you know, harken back to 1991 when the TCPA was passed, because we've gotten so far afield from the language of the statute and how it's actually defined as equipment that has a capacity that uses a random or sequential number generator, because Nicole, as you point out, the technology has changed so much. And so have the means and strategies to reach people. In the debt collection industry, there's absolutely no reason to use a random or sequential number generator. Why in the world would you randomly dial some number and you don't know who you're trying to reach? You know, and then that would, you know, then you get into other areas of law, that debt collection laws that could cause you problems. So what happened is, beginning really in around 2003, the FCC started issuing rulings that really expanded the statutory definition into something, in my view, that it's not even close to what it is or is meant to be, and began applying the ATDS definition to predictive dialers, which are, you know, fairly popular in the debt collection industry, because they're very efficient, and you could reach more people faster than you could if you just automatically manually punched in every number. And so you had FCC rulings in 2003, 2008, that applied the ATDS definition of predictive knowledge. Then you had the catastrophic ruling in 2015 that in many ways the SEC essentially said that any device that has the theoretical capacity to be an ATDS could be an ATDS. So suddenly—
like even my iPhone, right?
Yeah,
potential.
Exactly.
That's what we call potential. Right. Yeah, anything could potentially have the capacity to become an auto dialer. Like you don't even need a random or sequential number generator. But yeah, that was the arguments people were making. What about my telephone? That's completely, I could auto dial calls. And in fact, there were a lot of companies that were getting sued based upon these apps on people's phones that could mass text, even though it was a consumer that could mass text, so to speak, right?
Right. So I'm sorry to interrupt, Scott, but I thought one of the most interesting, and I'll use interesting parts of that 2015 omnibus ruling from the FCC was that the potential capacity issue, right? So like Nicole said, you have your iPhone that has the potential to do a whole myriad of things, including random and sequential dialing, but that it didn't even matter if what was required to trigger it to make it dial, to make it randomly sequence phone numbers, was human intervention, a piece of additional software, a piece of additional hardware. It didn't matter if you had to sort of add all of these other aspects onto it, just the fact that by itself, maybe it had the potential to do that, but that potential would only exist if you added on 16 other components. According under the 2015 omnibus ruling, the FCC didn't care about that. And it didn't matter, which was why, as Scott rightfully said, it was quite catastrophic, and which was why ACA International decided not to take it lying down and challenged the 2015 omnibus ruling in the way that they did and received the result that they did, which was really, really significant for the industry. Now, I think, unfortunately, where that left us was with this big open void, because while it invalidated that interpretation under the omnibus ruling, it left us in the exact same position as we were in before, with courts across the country doing sort of whatever it is that they wanted to with their interpretation, taking fresh interpretations of the statute. And now, as I'm sure we'll get into later, we've got these circuit splits across the country defining what an ATDS is.
And I think even the district courts were confused after the DC's opinion in ACA International, because they really didn't know how far it went. Because, you know, there was also some interpretations that were in the prior 2003 and 2008 rulings that went unchallenged, but that were kind of wrapped into the 2015 ruling or restated. So the question became, well, do those rulings still stand then? Or is everything invalidated? What do we do with this? All we know is that, you know, at least according to the DC circuit, this definition is inaccurate of some sort. So what do we do now? And so pretty much litigation ensued, so to speak. And as I know a lot of you attendees know, I mean, this can be bet the company litigation, you know, depending upon insurance, depending upon, you know, what type of pockets are available. And, you know, these types of suits not only hit debt collectors, they hit the creditors, because calls made on behalf of the creditor are attributed to the creditor, at least according to the FCC. So, you know, this left a lot of people in really expensive litigation that either, you know, they had to fight in order to starve off these lawsuits. And, you know, the other problem that came into play was, if you didn't use this type of technology, at least this is what, you know, some of my clients said, you pretty much got priced out of the game of getting these clients that people wanted, the creditors, because, you know, you couldn't be as efficient in contacting, you know, these consumers unless you were utilizing some type of technology, which led a lot of my clients and, you know, a lot of those in the industry to try to find types of software that, you know, didn't fit the mold of ATDS, right? So how do we kind of determine what that is? So I guess we can kind of start with the largest decision, so to speak, coming after ACA International, which was the highly anticipated Crunch case, Marks versus Crunch Fitness. And that came out of the Ninth Circuit, and unsurprisingly to me, just because it's in the Ninth Circuit, and I'm sure, you know, you would agree with me out there on that one, Scott, but, you know, and Dara, I know you and I have been in the Ninth Circuit together as well, that, you know, at least in my experience, they have a tendency to bend over backwards in the consumer protection sphere, so to speak. So in Marks versus Crunch San Diego, which came down September 2018, we had a instance where a consumer received three text messages, everyone. Oh, the privacy that's been invaded. And of course, filed a class action. And it, you know, went through the district court. The district court actually ruled the system could not be an ATDS because, let's go back to the statutory definition, no random or sequential number generator. Additionally, this particular system that Crunch was using actually required human intervention to input the numbers into the platform, which most do. And so the district court used those two features to ultimately decide that the system was not an ATDS and dismiss the case. Well, the Ninth Circuit decided that the district court was incorrect.
It actually on both counts.
On both counts.
On both counts.
Yes, both counts, basically. And that the statutory definition was ambiguous on its face. I don't know about that, but... it went on to examine the context and the structure of the statutory scheme to try to determine what Congress intended. That's what happens when a statutory definition is ambiguous, or at least decided to be ambiguous. And it said that basically the intent of the statute itself was to regulate devices that make automatic calls, including automatic calls from lists of recipients. So in short, we're going to try to go with what Congress intended and use the broadest definition we can think of. To decide that to be an ATDS, the equipment must have had the capacity to store numbers to be called or to produce numbers to be called using a random or sequential number generator and to dial such numbers. So think about that, right? You must have the capacity to store numbers to be called and to dial such numbers or to produce numbers to be called using that random or sequential number generator and to dial such numbers. So in that case, you basically have a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that's decided that if your system stores numbers and dials it, it's an ATDS. So fairly broad definition. Again, my iPhone probably, would constitute a dialer under that. Interestingly, it didn't decide the capacity issue that Dara mentioned that was a big problem with the FCC's 2015 ruling, talking about whether something has to have the current capacity to auto-dial or the future potential capacity to auto-dial. It declined, but this was kind of the first big, decision, so to speak, in my view, on, you know, what constitutes an auto-dialer. So this did not help to shrink the litigation pool. The plaintiffs bar loved this. They thought it was fantastic. And so that was the first. Now, after that point, actually the vast majority of the circuit courts decided really contrary to the Ninth Circuit.
Before we get into the other circuits, I wanted to add a few things on Marks.
Do it.
It's bad out here. My clients are ready to leave California in the Ninth Circuit, and at this point, I don't blame them. But Marks v. Crunch, there are two more important things about that decision. One, the definition requires the capacity to dial automatically, and the Ninth Circuit went further and said it need not be fully automatic, whatever that means. But that was the one sliver of, daylight. Where from a defense perspective, we can argue that there are some systems that are not automatic. They don't have the capacity to dial automatically, which has actually been tested in a few cases out here in California. And the good news is there's been at least one district court decision involving LiveVox HCI, which has been tested in many courts, but this was tested under Marks, And the district court applied sort of a pseudo human intervention test and held that the device that LiveVox HCI did not have the capacity, or at least the plaintiff had not shown that it had the capacity to dial automatically. So that's been an important distinction with respect to marks. The other thing that the Ninth Circuit did is they agreed that the 2003 and 2008 SEC orders with respect to predictive dialers were thrown out by the DC Circuit and ACA International. You know, functionally, you know, how does that, you know, does that really matter in the Ninth Circuit because of the, you know, it's otherwise the Ninth Circuit's broad definition of ATDS, you know, it may not help that much, but it was interesting that the Ninth Circuit did agree on that piece that predictive dialers are now out, at least with respect to those prior FCC rulings. So yeah, things are very difficult out here in the Ninth Circuit because, you know, Nicole and Derry, you touched on it. It is challenging to distinguish equipment from the definition under marks, particularly, you know, anyone's cell phone, which is interesting. The ACA International decision actually raised that as a concern with the FCC's prior order in 2015, that, you know, one might be able to argue that every person in America who's making phone calls from their smartphone is potentially violating the TCPA. And then yet you have the Ninth Circuit you know, coming up with this really broad definition that's never been you know, never been articulated before.
Scott, those district court decisions you were talking about that came down after marks, were those click to dial? That's like LiveDoc's HCL is, yeah, the click to dial, right? So that's where the number populates on the screen, and then the rep actually has to press the click in order to get it to dial. But the numbers itself pop up like systemically, basically, right?
Exactly, exactly. And you know, the Ninth Circuit has, you know, there's a follow-up case to marks called Duguid v. Facebook, which sort of, you know, reconsidered the marks issue. Facebook had raised again the definition of marks, and even raised with the Ninth Circuit again, said, hey, you know, if this is this definition in the Ninth Circuit really could implicate everyday smartphones. And I'm paraphrasing here, but the Ninth Circuit said, oh, that's too bad. And didn't, you know, didn't really take that head on. So Facebook did file a cert petition to the Supreme Court, it has not been granted. You know, we can talk about, you know, the recent Supreme Court TCPA decision, you know, perhaps later on, but that's, you know, that's the latest from the Ninth Circuit out here. And, you know, Nicole and Dara, if you want to, you know, get into one of the other circuits, you know, please do, or I'm happy to continue.
Second, third, 11th, yeah, seventh. I mean, where do we want to go?
I like all those better than the ninth. Each one of those I enjoy better than the Ninth Circuit.
Although the Second Circuit is having a little bit of an identity crisis, though, because it was like, no, we're going to take a narrower definition. No, just kidding. We changed our mind. Now we want to agree with the Ninth Circuit. So maybe maybe we can talk about the Second, and then we can talk about some of the other circuits that sort of fall in line. Does that sound good to everybody?
Sounds good to me.
All right. So let's see. So I think we should start with Second Circuit sort of decision in King versus Time Warner Cable, right? That was, although that came after the Third Circuit decision, right?
It was Dominguez, I think, was first.
It was Dominguez, then Time Warner. So really quick, let's go over the Third Circuit. And I know that for those listening on the call, the Third Circuit is not necessarily the most debt collection friendly circuit out there. But in this case, it actually, Dominguez versus Yahoo actually took a position with regards to a definition of an ATDS that was, I won't go so far to say was industry friendly, but at least was industry reasonable. And it was a reasonable position that I think everyone could wrap their brains around. And at least in my view, sort of fell more in line with the plain language of the TCPA. Because I personally, and this is my personal opinion, don't think that the statute is necessarily ambiguous on its face. I think it's just old. So the technology that existed at the time it was written was perfectly clear, and there's a ton of legislative history and notes and commentary from all of the hearings that went into enacting that legislation that tells you exactly what they intended when they passed the legislation, what it applied to and what it didn't. So to me, the Dominguez case actually took a much more straightforward interpretation of that, and really, and very took a very much narrow position versus what the Ninth Circuit did in Marx. So the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit narrowed that approach and essentially held that a device must be able to generate random or sequential numbers to qualify as an ATDS. That must, as opposed to the may or capacity, is very significant and very important as it makes it a strict requirement for your system. And then almost concurrently, the Second Circuit took a nearly identical approach in the King versus Time Warner cable case. And those two decisions actually came a few months before the Marx case, right?
True. Yeah, I think right. They were in June or something, so yeah.
So we had sort of this flurry of decisions where industry is saying, oh, look, the Third Circuit did something nice for us. The Second Circuit agreed with the Third Circuit. And then, of course, the Ninth Circuit came in with its hammer as it tends to do, which then obviously, and it was that sort of trifecta of cases that created the real split in terms of the post 2015, you know, split definition to how we're dealing with an ATDS.
And then Dominguez and King as well, they look also specifically looked at should it be present or future capacity, right? And both of them said present capacity. Like, yeah, we're not talking
your system about- has right. Your system has to be able to do that right now, not what it could do, not how you might be able to configure it one day, even though you as an organization have absolutely no intentions of configuring it that way. Which makes sense because when we're talking about an active piece of litigation, it's what happened. What is the harm, right? And even if we're talking about statutory harm, what is the harm that occurred for the act that already occurred? Not that you can't sue on acts that might occur in the future. That doesn't, you know, that's a big no-no under the federal rules. We're not talking about future claims. We're talking about your actual claim and what happened. So to me, that interpretation makes perfect sense. What could your system do at the time of the alleged violation, and what can it do now? Not what might your system be able to do at some point in the future, but actually has no bearing on the claims of the particular consumer or class of consumers at issue in the case.
I always thought it was completely illogical that there was any talk about future capacity. Like, how would you even be able to determine? Everything would be hypothetical. You know, you're talking about something that you don't know for sure could actually happen. It's too theoretical really to pin down when you're talking about something like that. So these two decisions made a lot of sense on that point. So,
right. And then
sensible analysis when it comes to the TCPA, because so often you have the FCC or some courts trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. A square peg being what the FCC or the courts want to be, and the round hole being the actual statutory definition of an ATDS. Technology and procedures have changed, so it's no longer, you don't even see random or sequential number generators really. I mean, I honestly don't know a single company, and certainly none of my clients, that use random and sequential number generators. So kind of now that we're moving chronologically, it's nice that you have, you know, Dominguez, you know, King weighed in the Second Circuit. And then, you know, for a time there in 2018 and moving into early 2019, you did have a circuit split, and district courts were deciding kind of whether they agreed with the Marx camp or really the Dominguez camp in the Third Circuit. And, you know, there's a flurry of different decisions. The human intervention analysis came into play in different ways, depending on what court you were before. And so there's a real, I think, a real desire on behalf of various industries to have more circuit courts weigh in. But, you know, it was sort of a crapshoot. You know, if you're not in the Ninth Circuit, Third Circuit, or, you know, or the Second Circuit too, to some extent, it's kind of a crapshoot. If you wanted to challenge whether or not the equipment that you're using meets the definition or not. And, you know, it really can be a bet the company type of challenge, particularly with class actions, where, you know, you could have thousands, millions of calls. There are cases that, you know, have exposure in the billions. And if the only real issue in the case is whether or not the equipment met the definition of an ATDS, you know, oftentimes, you know, from a defense perspective, you really want to be sure that you have a solid case. So there's a lot of uncertainty during this time, which then leads us to the 11th Circuit that weighed in 2019 in Glasser. The 11th Circuit is now my favorite circuit in the TCPA, not just because of Glasser, but because they've been just hammering the plaintiffs bar on TCPA cases. This is true. I considered taking the Florida bar just because I found myself getting pro hoc so much in the Florida, and there are so many filings in Florida involving TCPA cases that thought, yeah, maybe I should. I'm glad.
Also, the governor reopened the beaches in Florida, so
yeah, and also,
that's kind
yeah,
of exciting
yeah,
too.
Maybe I'll do it now so I can get out there. But yeah, it's you know, you had this 11th Circuit decision now in Glasser that really agreed with Dominguez, but in a more thorough analysis, got into, you know, really the arguments about grammar that the Ninth Circuit sort of twisted around. And, you know, some of these circuit decisions, you need a PhD in grammar just to figure out kind of what their arguments are. But to me, it's kind of a simple argument that this is what the statute says is meant to apply to equipment that has a capacity to generate random or sequential, to use a random or sequential number generator. And so Glasser said that, yeah, you need to actually have the capacity to generate random or sequential number, to call numbers using a random or sequential number generator, which is a really, really big deal. Of course, that doesn't take away TCPA cases that have nothing to do or do not rely on use of an ATDS, you know, calls using a pre-recorded voice, telemarketing, yeah, fax cases, things like that. But that was a really great ruling. And to me, it seemed like the tide was turning against Marks. And by that time, the majority of district court decisions had rejected Marks.
I thought the 11th Circuit decision also was really significant in the preview dialing human intervention language that was in there. So the other point that I thought was important, and I know I'd consistently made arguments and drawn analogies off of this interpretation in the 11th Circuit, is that they were specific. So where an operator had to push a button to make a call or transmit a text, and what, you know, they referred to as preview dialing, because the number appeared on the screen so that the button to transmit, like Nicole said before, needed to preview and then hit click, that human intervention precluded the device from being an auto dialer, which I think was the logical sort of human intervention argument that we had all sort of logically thought about as making sense, right? How can it be automatic if, you know, you need a human to click the button, or you need something to click the button? So I thought Glasser was significant in that as well, being sort of put that issue to rest, at least in the 11th Circuit.
Scott, I like how you mentioned the whole pre-recorded voice thing, because I feel like that's something that people forget a lot of the time, is that, you know, we spend so much time talking about the definition of an ATDS that sometimes I think people forget on a business level that, you don't need to go through that analysis if we're talking about a pre-recorded voice. If you're using a pre-recorded voice, it's TCPA all over the place. So you better make sure you have consent. No one's going to be asking you about your system functionalities. We're not going to have to go through that. It's either pre-recorded or it's not pre-recorded. People have tried to make creative arguments about how voices that are not in real time are not pre-recorded for whatever reason, but in my view, it's not worth the fight. So, you know, just something to consider as we go through these cases. If you're using a pre-recorded voice, you know, that's you better have your consent there. So,
although I would say, and Mike, maybe this can be the subject of a future webinar, the whole idea of the pre-recorded voice and the different technologies there, whether you're talking about text-to-speech or soundboard technology or IVA or this, that, and the other, is just, you know, a whole other slew of analysis and different set of court decisions that have nothing to do with automated dialing, sequential numbers, random numbers, but that are incredibly significant under the TCPA. I don't know that we'd have enough time or we've prepped to talk about it, but that's, Nicole's absolutely right. You can't forget about that part because so much of what goes into your effective messaging, whether you're talking about inbound calls and in this case, outbound calls, will really center around that issue. And once you've dialed the number, what it is you're doing and how you're communicating, you know, with the end consumer there. And if you get part A right, the ATDS part, you still have to contend with part B. And if part B squarely fits under that definition, as Nicole referenced before, you're in it. You're in TCPA land, and there's nothing we can do about that.
But we were all really, I think, excited after that 11th Circuit case, where like the tide is going in our way. We have more more in our arsenal to fight this. And then we had the Sixth Circuit come down in Carey versus True Blue, which essentially had, again, kind of tactically blessed the definition without really going into too much there, but they seem to be in the same camp about requiring the whole randomly or sequential number generator to dial or text phone numbers. And I think everyone felt good about that. And then the Seventh Circuit came down and they said something similar. They were all about it. Essentially, you know, I can never pronounce that.
Gadelak? Is it Gadelak? Yeah. No. We're thinking. Oh, we'll just call it AT&T.
AT&T. So that came down, and that essentially held that a system that dials from a customer database is not considered the ATDS. They looked at the statutory definition, the use of the phrase using a random or sequential number generator, found that it modified both store and produce, and as such, they ruled that it was necessary to find the ATDS. And since AT&T system dialed from a customer database, they were in the clear, so to speak. Which, you know, we were all cheering. And then what happened?
Before we get to the next, the surprise, most recent news, I'm wondering, Nicole and Dara, whether you would have predicted the Seventh Circuit coming down in this way in the AT&T case. I'll tell you, I would not have bet on it based on the Seventh Circuit. I feel like the Seventh Circuit and the Ninth Circuit are spirit animals.
I'll let Nicole go first. You can go ahead and then I'll share.
Okay,
my two
then
cents.
You talk.
Sitting here in Chicago right now.
I know. Well, technically I'm sitting in Michigan, so I'm in the Sixth Circuit. So I don't even know. I must have lost my ability. But anyways, so my thought on the Seventh Circuit is that we are less predictable than I feel like other circuits, particularly the Ninth Circuit. Like the Ninth Circuit, I've argued before them, you just know how consumer friendly they are. But in the Seventh, it has a really great dependence on what panel you get. And the way that we do appeals here is different than other circuits in that you don't even know who your panel is until the morning of, and you show up and you're like, surprise, you get Diane Wood, and everyone's like, boo, you know? So I don't know that I am as surprised, so to speak, just because we are so random. Also, I do, when I think about it on my own, and I don't think about any court interpretations, but I read the language myself, it's the same conclusion that I come to. You know, I know we're going to talk about Boom Goes the Dynamite, the Disco in a minute, but anyways, so I guess I wasn't completely surprised, but go ahead, Dara.
I would agree with your sentiments, Nicole. The Seventh Circuit, I think, has pleasantly surprised us before. Particularly when I also think it matters a great deal as to which lower court it's coming out of. I think if you're getting an appeal from a district court in Wisconsin versus a district court in Illinois, the way those, the reasoning of those opinions comes through ends up impacting the Seventh Circuit a lot, particularly depending, you know, if they're reviewing something de novo, I think it can be surprise, surprise. But if they are reviewing something for an abuse of discretion and depending on sort of procedurally where you are in the case, the Seventh Circuit has surprised us before. And district courts within the Seventh Circuit, particularly in the Northern District of Illinois, have surprised us pleasantly before too. There's definitely our fair share of very consumer-friendly jurists within those district courts. But the Seventh Circuit jurists are a real mixed bag. We've definitely got those judges who I think probably maybe philosophically fall more in line with we would call a more liberal Ninth Circuit approach. And then you forget that there are a lot of Seventh Circuit jurists, and where we sit in, you know, Chicago as a sort of financial services hub in the country, like there are a lot of very business friendly judges sitting within the district courts and within the Seventh Circuit. And Nicole is right, because we don't always know who we're going to get until the very, very last minute, it does seem to be a little bit of a crapshoot, but I think our odds are better in the Seventh Circuit than they are in the Ninth. And generally, I think our odds are better in the Seventh Circuit than even in the Third consumer related issues. And sometimes even when we get decisions we don't like, we can see how the judges got there. And I don't know that we read decisions coming out of the Seventh Circuit as, I have no idea how they got there, or I have no idea, you know, what that reasoning is, or they really stretched it here. That's, in my view, practicing in the circuit predominantly, I feel like that's less likely than sort of the, you know, scratch your head moment that we have sometimes when we read Ninth Circuit decisions.
So let's go to what I like to call Boom Goes the Dynamite, just because it's just fun to say, but it's Duran versus LaBoom Disco, Second Circuit. And this is where the Second Circuit, again, like Dara, you said, has a kind of an identity crisis about their definition of ATDS. They ultimately decided more in the Ninth Circuit camp than they did with the majority here.
And themselves,
which was also odd, because if you all recall, when we were initially discussing these different definitions in the King case, or not the King case, I'm sorry. Yeah, was it it's the King versus
Time Warner.
You know, they took what we thought was, you know, more of the Third Circuit's approach. And then this case came down recently. They decided that devices with the capacity to store or produce numbers using a random or sequential number generator are ATDSs, which is not a surprise, but as well as devices that merely store numbers to be dialed automatically. So very similar to what we discussed in the Marks case. The court looked at the statutory language to make this determination, and they felt that the word store in the statute would serve no purpose if they didn't interpret it in that manner, because all random numbers are stored within an ATDS and must have been previously generated. Now, the more interesting part, I guess, because again, I don't agree with them on that point, but is their take on human intervention, which I think is a little bit more interesting to talk about. In this particular case, LaBoom Disco argued that human intervention was present here to dispel the automatic nature of dialing these numbers because an employee must trigger the messages to be sent. So essentially, if my understanding is correct, according to the system, you know, some employee would have had to, you know, schedule these messages being sent at the particular time and trigger them, but they still went out in mass. So the questions that have arisen here as a result of this decision is how much human intervention is enough to dispel the notion that these numbers are dialed automatically. What are your thoughts on this, guys?
Well, so just in Disco, Boom Goes the Dynamite, or whatever really fun
Boom
name.
Boom does the gut, yep. I got to keep it fresh over here.
I understand.
It's the pandemic.
we all got quarantine brain, guys. It's okay. We do these small things to keep ourselves entertained and then hopefully you entertained as well. So just want to make sure that we're all sort of operating on the same wavelength. What Duran versus LaBoom Disco Inc. essentially said is that clicking the send button, right, that click was just not enough human intervention to preclude a system from being an ATDS. And I think in anticipation of the potential backlash for that, the court also distinguished sort of the regular smartphones, stating that those devices require someone to click a name and a contact or type all the digits to initiate a call or text, which is a form of, I think what they called it, constructive dialing or speed dialing. So they knew that they were going to irritate people with sort of the decision and put in this dicta about when we're not talking about when someone picks up their smartphone, scrolls through a contact and, you know, has to do all of these things. So I guess that goes back to your question, Nicole, like how much is enough? Well, I think at a minimum under Duran, it's got to be more than the one click send, right?
Yeah.
Who knows what Diane Wood would say, you know, is enough, but we do know that at least under Duran and the Second Circuit, it's got to be more than the just one click. Incrementally, how much more? I think honestly is anybody's guess.
And Duran was analyzing the easy texting system,
yep.
Which is also owned by CallFire. The systems actually are the same. Until then, easy texting and CallFire had a very good run of things, having several district courts hold that not only does the platform not meet the human intervention test, but also it doesn't have the capacity, it does not use a random or sequential number generator. And then here comes, you know, LaBoom saying, well, you know, not so fast, a one click, you know, mass texting platform is going to be an ATDS in the Second Circuit. One other thing that was interesting about LaBoom is it disagreed with Marx on the predictive dialer issue and said, well, actually, the 2003 and 2008 predictive dialer rulings survived ACA International. So in that single issue, it distinguished itself from the Ninth Circuit. But, you know, the Second Circuit definition is by all accounts extremely broad, and with respect to texting, makes it a very, you know, dangerous place to, you know, to send out any one-click mass texting without a really good TCPA compliance program in place.
That's a good point. And the courts are uniform for those of you out there that are thinking, well, what about texts? They're kind of mentioning texts, but texts are calls. I don't know of any court that has disagreed. The FCC has come down and said texts are calls. So when you're looking at an analytical or you're analyzing a software system or hardware system that you're going to use, you just need to assume if you're texting, consider it a call. Use the same type of analytics. We do have a question here that I think would be interesting to go through from Jody. And I'll read it aloud. We are in Georgia. Just curious because it is so vague. We use a dialer system, but we populate the dialer accounts with call lists by clients. The account call list is not random, but built by specific criteria such as turnover date, balance, employment. Is this an ATDS by definition? And as everyone knows on the call, we are lawyers, but we are not your lawyers. So we cannot give you specific legal advice. Unless you want to retain and pay us. But I will like hypothetically answer this question because this is a question I get a lot, which is I'm in state X. My law is what it is here. What is my system okay? So there's two answers to this question, right? One is Georgia's in the 11th Circuit. It's our happy place of yay, unless you're using a random or sequential number generator in your system, which I should mention a random or sequential number generator means what it is, what means what it says. It's random. It's not based upon lists of numbers that are populated into your system. It is, you know, taking
using
one, two, three,
defined
four, five.
Criteria. Right.
Right. So that's not what Jody here is talking about. But so in the 11th Circuit, by that definition, they should be A-okay in theory. But I will tell you, the 11th Circuit is not the only thing that you need to be looking at because you're going to call into a different state. You have a whole nother thing to go for. There's two places that you're going to realistically get sued for a TCPA violation. It's the state where your office is located, where you're placing those calls, or it's the place those are being received, or hypothetically even your principal place of business, state of incorporation, which you could be subject to general jurisdiction. So you have to look at really jurisdictionally, what are the laws that could come into play? And that's why this makes it so difficult for everyone to comply, because we have scenarios where this Georgia agency could be all well and good under, you know, the 11th Circuit authority, but they're calling California. And once they call into California, that California consumer can call and say, guess what? I'm in California, I'm in the 9th Circuit, and so the 9th Circuit law applies, and that system that you're using is an ATDS, and now you're subject to $500 per call or $1,500 per call, depending upon, you know, what I'm feeling like at this particular moment, whether you're willfully terrible or not. Yeah, so, go ahead.
And I'm seeing that in the 9th Circuit in California in particular. The plaintiffs far as jumping over, you know, jumping backwards, jumping through every hoop to try to venue their case in California under Marks. And I expect they're gonna do that in the Second Circuit as well. But you don't, those aren't the only two circuits you gotta worry about, because in every other circuit where there isn't binding authority, it's still up, the definition is still up for grabs. And you'll have plaintiffs argue that Marks, that the court should follow Marks, or it should follow LeBoum. Another thing that I've seen, a recent trend in litigation, is even in those jurisdictions where the circuits have binding authority following the statutory definition, plaintiffs are trying to come up with, as they do, creative arguments to try to get around that. So, you know, the question, which I assume is hypothetical, talks about uploading a call list to a system. So what plaintiffs are arguing now is, let's say, for example, someone is using an Excel spreadsheet and uploads an Excel spreadsheet, a contact list into, you know, insert the blank system. Plaintiffs are saying, well, look, that Excel spreadsheet has the ability to randomize numbers, to put them in sequential order. And isn't that the use of a random or sequential number generator? And so I'm seeing that actually quite a bit. I think it's creative, but I also think it's wrong. There are a few courts that have decided that issue. One of the more recent ones out of Rhode Island called DECAPUA, D-E-C-A-P-U-A. And it was a case where, actually another easy texting case on a motion to dismiss. And there the plaintiffs made that precise argument. They said, well, look, you know, the defendant uploaded an Excel spreadsheet and that could be randomized. So isn't this still a random or sequential number generator? The magistrate judge said no, that was essentially appealed, objected to the district court judge. The district court judge said, no, this is not an ATVS following decisions like Dominguez. Interestingly, that has been appealed to the First Circuit recently. And so we might see, as a result of that appeal, the First Circuit weigh in as well. So it's, you know, I guess the punchline here for everybody is you got to be careful as to, you know, what you're doing, where you're doing it, and how you're doing it, and don't trust that your vendors are telling you everything that you need to know about the equipment you're using. You know,
I like that point a lot. That's a really good point, because remember, the vendors that are selling you the equipment have an interest in selling you the equipment. So it's really a good idea, if you're going to make the investment in a system like that, to actually go to some objective third party or your trusted counsel, and have them take a look at it, because the money that you will save in that small amount of inquiry could be life-saving. We have a couple other quick questions that I'll just read, because I know we're coming to the end of our hour. Somebody asks, using a pre-recorded voice, are you referring, if there's no answer, a pre-recorded voicemail is left? Is that what you're referring to? It could be that circumstance, or it could be if you pick up the phone and you have like a pre-recorded somebody or other say, hello, please hold for your operator. This is blah, 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 calling. So it could be that. It also could be, you know, in theory, some type of AI. You know, there's obviously expansive definitions, but generally it's pre-recorded voice messages. And then we have one question about unattended dialer campaigns. What are your thoughts on unattended dialer campaigns? I don't understand that question. Because in that case, I would assume it would be a ATDS and the TCPA would come into play, and you might annoy people with unattended dialer campaigns, but that's just my take.
The one thing I wanted to sort of add, Scott, onto what you were saying before is that you're right. So there are circuits out there that don't have very clear circuit court precedent, but I would also caution everyone to say that circuits change their minds. Mm-hmm. So even while your district court will be bound by whatever circuit court precedent is currently in play, that precedent is only as good as the circuit decides to keep itself aligned with its previous school of thought. Circuits change their minds all the time. We saw the Second Circuit do that too. So depending on who your plaintiff's counsel is and their appetites for litigating, you know, just because you prevail at the district court does not mean the case is over. While this is a very lawyerly and somewhat undara-like thing for me to say, is you're probably not safe no matter what anywhere, because there isn't going to be one definition or one set of procedures where you know is gonna give you a rubber stamp and you're gonna be quote unquote okay no matter what jurisdiction that you're in. There is a higher likelihood in other jurisdictions than others. But for me, when I'm working with clients on this, we try to sort of rewind it, because remember, whether or not you're using an ATDS, there's another issue that we haven't talked about here today a lot, but that is very significant and comes into play and can be very critical when it comes to sort of defeating a class action claim. And those are issues surrounding consent and what your clients do to obtain consent for what they can do, and the types of equipment, what's included in your consent, what isn't included in your consents, how you obtain them, the frequency at which you obtain them, how you record revocation, and all of those things. So to me, that's the best insurance. Consent is the best. Consent is the best insurance, not trying to sort of strategically figure out what jurisdictions you're going to make calls in using what information, because the law changes, unfortunately, and court's interpretation of the law then continuously changes, which is why we're all sitting with Mike on a webinar today talking to you about how the courts keep changing their minds.
So maybe we should talk before, in our last minute, where this goes, because now we have a circuit split, a real circuit split. There is, we didn't talk about this, but the DC Circuit opinion, ATA International, kicked back to the FCC to reconsider the definition of the ATDS. The TRACE Act was recently passed. That also directed the FCC to come up with to consider and come up with regulations concerning an ATDS. And so, you know, where does this go? Because we've got a Supreme Court really that could be in a position to weigh in on it. It decided not to grant cert in the Facebook case, which really teed up sort of in a backdoor constitutional argument manner, teed up the ATDS issue. And the SEC has sort of sat on its hands while some of these things have played out. So curious about predictions. I don't know if we have time, but maybe Nicole or Dara. I mean, I'll just tell you Maya quickly. I don't think this gets resolved until the Supreme Court weighs in. Because already, you know, courts have said they're not, especially in the Ninth Circuit, they said, you know, even if the SEC weighs in, we're bound by the Ninth Circuit authority and we're not changing our mind.
What do you think, Nicole?
Sure. Sorry, I totally got distracted for a moment there. So I'm going to just go to Dara on that one.
So part of me agrees, Scott, that it won't be until sort of the U.S. Supreme Court states its piece. I don't think it's going to be anytime. I don't think it's going to be anytime soon for a variety of reasons, not the least of which have to do with sort of the current political climate, the composition of the current executive branch, the composition of our lawmakers. And I think that honestly, it's probably not top of mind for the FCC anyway, and they'll be able to get away with not doing anything for a very long time, and nobody in Washington is going to make them. So that's my sort of pessimistic view on it, which is why I sort of say if we want to wait around for the regulators to tell us what to do, we'll all be waiting for a very long time. How long have we waited for CFPB rulemaking? I mean, I don't think that's a way responsibly to sort of run any of your businesses, which is why I always go back to sort of having a robust compliance management system and taking control over what you can take control of, as opposed to the court system and the lawmakers and the regulators, which we can't control.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Supreme Court had oral argument on the constitutionality of the government-backed debt exception to the ATDS restriction. And I can tell you how many times I heard a justice comment that the TCPA is such a popular statute. It seems like in the general public view, they find it popular. I don't know. I haven't seen polling on it, but that was interesting that several justices made that comment.
Well, it looks to me like they might strike down that government debt exemption. I listened to the oral arguments and did a Slack channel thing for Mike on that case. And it looks to me like it's pretty likely that they're thinking about striking down that exemption. It'll just be more interesting to see whether they sever it or whether they hold it unconstitutional. I don't think they're going to do that, but who knows?
Let's hope the justices were talking about the telemarketing part of the TCPA, and right. That maybe that's the popular part of the statute, as opposed to them talking about us, who are not telemarketers.
That could True. Just be scary on top of this ambiguous Sunday.
Correct.
So, well, listen, we've definitely run over our time, but this has been a very fascinating discussion. So, Scott, Nicole, Dara, thank you so much for walking us through and answering questions and trying to shed some light on how companies in this industry can define an ATDS. I really appreciate you helping provide that analysis. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you all.
Anytime.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Stay tuned. We've got more webinars coming up tomorrow and Friday. You can check them out on accountsrecovery.net. And we hope everybody stays safe, and we'll see you soon. Thank you.
Thanks.